Kia ora and welcome to Airman's Podcast, episode 279. Today is Friday, May 18, 2012. Yes, it's been a while. No, I'm not going to talk about it. I've just been doing everyday mundane sorts of things, and it's just not very interesting. So that's why I'm not talking about it. There's nothing going on, no secrets or anything. Just not interesting. So today I am going to tell you about some things going on, including actually a very strange update on the house situation, and other bits and pieces. But first, today's main topic, which I called this episode Proper Words, because it relates to the marriage equality debate. I posted on my blog recently a post that is called, call it up so I can see, Marriage is Marriage. And the point of that post, and I'll put a link in the show notes, is that there's no such thing as gay marriage. It's called marriage. And the question is whether or not same-sex couples will be allowed to participate in this thing called marriage. And it's a bit of a sore point for me, as the post actually explains, because when it's called gay marriage, or even same-sex marriage, but particularly gay marriage, it frames the debate in a certain way, that this is a weird thing, an other kind of thing, and it's a special right, which is what the right wing always calls it. So if we call it by its proper name, marriage, or refer to marriage equality, then we're talking about what we're talking about and not this weird ethereal thing out there. And this all came, and what specifically caused that to come to my attention, to get my attention, I guess, is that after President Obama issued his statement calling for the right of, or stating his support for the right of same-sex couples to marry, we had a bit of a Twitter storm, as I call it, here in New Zealand. What happened basically is that some of the folks that I follow on Twitter, some of the New Zealand folks, started saying, when is Labour going to say that it's for marriage equality? And some of the other people started, some of the Labour people, the politicians, elected or otherwise, started saying, well, it already has. And this kept going back and forth for quite a while. Finally, the deputy leader of the party, Grant Robertson, who is openly gay and the MP for Wellington Central, tweeted that the current Labour Party leader, David Shearer, had actually expressed his support for marriage equality at the Big Gay Out last December. Now, the Big Gay Out is this big festival sort of thing in Auckland, I think it's in Point Chevalier somewhere. Anyway, in Auckland City. And it's held every year. It's a very big deal. The Prime Minister of the day and the leader of the opposition of the day attend, and they bring their senior MPs with them, usually, or at least the ones relating to Auckland. And in the case of, well, last year, what got most of the notoriety was that Prime Minister John Key was asked specifically if there was a conscience vote held today, would he vote in favor of civil unions? Because remember that he voted against civil unions when he was just an ordinary MP back in 2004. And he refused to answer it. He said, you have to read my book. And so if he wouldn't say how he was going to vote on civil unions, everyone just assumed that he would then be against marriage equality. So that then begs the question, what is the position of the Labour leader, David Shearer? And that's why Grant Robertson quoted that. Now, I have to admit, and I'm fairly reasonably widely read in the news anyway, and I never saw that, probably because John Key's remarks overshadowed it, and also because the mainstream media doesn't generally cover the Big Gay Out. So I missed it entirely. But what he said was that he supported it subject to seeing the legislation. And that, frankly, wasn't good enough for those of us on Twitter. We just seen President Obama, after years of equivocation, finally say, yes, I think that same-sex couples should be allowed to marry. And here's David Shearer saying, I support it, but I'd have to see the legislation. Now, there's two things. First of all, a lot of us were thinking, well, of course, Labour writes the legislation. What is this equivocation about? Now, it's been pointed out that, in fact, if it happens in this term of Parliament, it would be coming in as what we call a private member's bill, which means it's not a government bill. And it could just as easily come from the Green Party, especially because they have had a really good luck getting members' bills introduced. The way it works is, essentially, it's like a lottery. They put all these members' bills into a hat, and they just pull the number, and whatever gets pulled then goes onto consideration. So it is possible that the bill that would actually go before Parliament might not be a Labour bill. It might be a Green Party bill. But he's a leader of a party. Doesn't it isn't it an automatic thing that he reads legislation before announcing that he's going to support it, especially a member's bill? I mean, this is just dumbfounding. So finally, this going back and forth all day, and we're pressuring the labor politicians of various sorts. And finally, he says, let me be clear that I support marriage equality. And he didn't try to equivocate. He didn't try to have a condition on there. And that's all we were asking for all along. So that was great. But then there was the larger question of the Labor Party itself. Does it or does it not support marriage equality? And it all comes down to words again. And part of the problem is that what the Labor Party bases their, the Labor politicians, I should say, base their conviction, shall we say, on about this whole marriage equality, what their marriage equality position is, what they base that on is their election manifesto from 2011, this past election. And what it is that it was on page 374, I just looked it up. They said that if elected to government, the party would, this is quote, review and update relationship and property, relationship property law. Well, what does that mean? Were they supporting marriage equality or weren't they? But that is why they were saying that they did. Now, the problem is that using the phrase review and update is simply not the same as saying that they would enact marriage equality. And to me and to several other people, it sounded like the party was equivocating and being noncommittal. And that is exactly why we were having this big Twitter storm on Friday, our time, I guess it must have been, Thursday, whatever the day was. I can't even remember now. And also a similar one, I was involved in a similar one on Saturday, our time, I think it was. And that's why. It was all because of that. It's the heart of what the whole thing was. We, on our side, don't see a commitment to marriage equality at all, and the Laborites are adamant that there is one, and that the party is on record as supporting it. And it all comes down to that one phrase, review and update. Now, I believe that the divide in perception is there because the section where it occurs is headlined, Bringing About Formal Equality Before the Law, which sort of sounds like they're talking about changing the law. And it begins with the sentence, New Zealanders in a same-sex relationship may enter into civil unions, which are not fully equivalent in the legal sense to marriage, and they may not enter into marriage. That's a direct quote. Now, in that context, they probably see review and update as meaning changing the law. However, it doesn't exactly say that. And to those of us who are arguing with them, update, and the word update, could simply mean that they're ensuring that civil unions are equivalent in every way to marriage, while still shutting same-sex couples out of marriage. So we were not happy about this situation, and it never was ultimately resolved. The Laborites are still adamant that their party supports marriage equality, and those of us who are not Labor Party politicians or activists or whatever are a bit more dubious. Some of the branches do. Young Labor unequivocally supports marriage equality and is in favor of changing the law. Young Labor is for those who I think are 25 and under, I believe it is. But, of course, that mirrors the situation pretty much in every developed country where where younger people fully support full marriage equality, and the older you get, the less likely somebody is to do so. The Greens, which is the other left-of-center party in New Zealand, do support marriage equality, but again, not literally. Now, their politicians have told me, and they say publicly that they do support marriage equality, and I actually think they've got more reason to say so than the Labor Party politicians. Their policy on their website, anyway, says that one of their policies under sexual orientation is this section. It says that they will extend all legal partnership arrangements and rights to same-sex couples. Now, is a bit vague, but I've been assured that that does mean they support marriage equality. And in fact, that's how I interpreted it the first time I wrote about it on my blog back in 2011, June, I think it was, of 2011. The reason that I saw it that way is that since gay and lesbian New Zealanders are barred only from marriage, that's the only legal partnership arrangement that can be extended. So it has to be about marriage equality. I would still prefer that they said explicitly what they support and what they don't support, but be that as it may. Now, just today, a politics lecturer in Dunedin at Otago University, and also a columnist, I suppose he is, at the New Zealand Herald, but his name is Bryce Edwards, published a, I guess it is a blog post, quoting all of some various New Zealand politicians on marriage equality. And what he does, he had this thing he called vote chat, where these various politicians came on, they talked about issues and so on. And he summarized what they said and posted links to the videos, so there's actual evidence of what they said. And so that's a useful resource, and if I remember, I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. But that's where we left it, basically. On the day that Obama declared his support, Labor was equivocating, the Labor leader was equivocating, and finally said unequivocally that he personally supports marriage equality, which is all we've been asking for all along. That day, that evening, John Key was asked by, I think it was an AP reporter or something like that, what his position was. And none of the New Zealand media thought to do this, apparently. And he said that there was no clamor in New Zealand to change the law, which was typical from him. He's such a whatever. Anyway, but then the next day, he said that he personally didn't have a problem with marriage equality, which is quite a difference from the guy who voted against civil unions in 2004. And then he went on to say that he was asked about, I think it was on a Monday, I believe it was, and in an interview, and he was said that he would probably support it on a first reading. Now, all bills that go before Parliament have three readings. The first one is basically its introduction, and if it passes that reading, it goes on to select committee. If it passes the first reading, it goes to select committee. And it's not unusual for the government to support a bill that it doesn't intend to back on the first reading so that it can go to select committee and then the public can have their say and so on. It's kind of a way of diffusing tension with the public. If the public is upset about something, it gives them the feeling that they're having a say, even if the government has no intention of listening to them. So it's kind of a circuit breaker in a way. And John Key's predecessor as leader of the National Party, Don Brash, also voted for the civil unions bill on the first reading so that it could go to select committee. He ultimately voted against it on the second and third readings, but be that as it may, he did support the first reading. So there's a precedent for this kind of thing going on. Now, when the bill, if a bill comes up this session, it probably won't. Well, it could do, but it's unlikely. If it does, I don't have any idea how the votes would fall. I saw one count of only part of Parliament, and it was an uphill battle. And part of it is because we don't have strong leadership on the part of Labor on this issue. And regardless of what they think, they're certainly not exercising strong leadership. And so I don't know if it would actually get through Parliament. But whatever, if it got to the final vote, it would almost certainly be a conscience vote, which means that they don't have to vote according to party policy. They can vote whatever way they want. And we would see some Labor MPs vote against it, and we would see some National MPs voting for it. We know that already because we know of at least two or three National Party MPs who have declared that they would vote in favor of it. And we know that there are probably several Labor Party MPs who would vote against it. So I have mixed feelings about that. On the one hand, you would think that any issue would be a conscience vote. In the U.S. House of Representatives, for example, which is most directly analogous to our parliament, every vote is a conscience vote because you don't have to vote according to what the party tells you to do. And that happens all the time. And it's one of the problems that people like John Boehner have. They can't corral their party people to vote in one way. They can exert pressure on their members and so on, but they can't force them to vote a certain way. In a parliamentary system, a Westminster-style parliamentary system, ordinarily, the caucus votes is one. And very rarely that somebody will buck the party and cross the aisle. They're usually expelled if they do that, expelled from caucus anyway. It depends on the situation. If they're a list MP, I believe they might even be expelled from Parliament. There's been a lot of debate back and forth about this, but that's a whole different issue. So on a conscience vote, they vote however they want. It doesn't matter what the parties do. And that's why it's so uncertain how this will all come down. The same thing is going on in Australia. The Australian Labor Party voted to make a vote on marriage equality a conscience vote. Whereas the Liberal National Opposition has said it will not be a conscience vote, and they're all going to have to vote against it. So that's why you can say with certainty that if marriage equality comes before the Australian House, it will fail. So I don't think it's going to come up there anytime soon either, to be honest. So it's all kind of in flux. But one of the things that was most interesting about all of this to me is that it was just a bunch of ordinary people. I was one of them who were pushing and pushing and pushing against the leader and leadership of the second biggest party in Parliament, who will most likely lead the next government. And we were able to convince them to change their ways, at least partly. I've never seen anything quite like that before. Certainly you don't generally see that in American politics, mostly because politicians usually have a staff member who interacts with people on Twitter, whereas in this case, more often than not, it was the actual politician or party activist or what have you who was interacting with us. Now, I would say that they got very frustrated with us for pushing the same point over and over and over again, but you know that goes with the territory. The thing, though, as I said, that I found remarkable was that they were interacting with us at all, because I've certainly never seen that before on Twitter or anywhere else for that matter. So that was kind of cool. Now, on to some other things. First, I'm going to stop. Sorry about that. I just had to stop and cough. So rather than cough in your ear, I hit the stop button. Anyway, what do I want to talk about next? As you well know, I have been struggling for quite a while with this podcast, trying to figure out what to do with it. Trying to find time to record, and I may or may not be able to get that part sorted out. But there's still the overall issue of how to structure it and so on. Longtime listeners may recall that I talked at one time about maybe tagging episodes a certain way so that people could subscribe to just what they wanted to hear and so on. While that's technically possible, I just don't think it's practical because it requires, but also expects people to take extra steps to get the stuff that they want to get. So I don't think that's a goer. Now, what this really is about primarily is about the whole expat stuff, the general topic of expatedness, if you will. And I don't see how it doesn't fit easily within the framework of this particular podcast, because most of this podcast is a personal journal podcast. It's my life as an American living in another country, blah, 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 blah. And somebody who wants to hear just the stuff about being an expat, whether it's an interview with somebody or whatever it is, has to wade through all the other stuff in order to get there. And similarly, there may be some people who couldn't care less about expat stuff. That's, you know, it's possible, although unlikely, but it's possible. So what I'm going to do instead is I am essentially going to split that off, just as it did with Too Political, because talk about U.S. politics didn't fit in this podcast. And I don't know the details. I don't know what it's going to be called. I don't know any of those sorts of things, but it's essentially going to be a standalone podcast that's just going to be about stuff relating to expatness. And I'm going to talk to other expats and all the things that I've wanted to get back to doing but haven't quite been able to be motivated enough to do. And those will still be posted to this feed, so nobody who listens to this now has to do a thing to get it. But anyone who doesn't want to hear all of the personal journal stuff can go over to the other one. See? I think it's fairly clear. But I'll talk about that more when I have the details worked out. But I've just come to this decision this week, in fact, within the past couple of days, because it's been bothering me for a long time now, and it ultimately, I think, is the most sensible and logical solution to this dilemma that I've been facing for quite some time. Now, I do have a couple of voicemail messages, and the first one is from Scotty the Little Aussie Battler, and I'm going to interrupt that partway through so that I can address what he's talking about at the time. So here's the message from Scotty.
G'day, Arthur. This is Scotty, a little Aussie battler, and I've got to leave this message now while listening to your podcast is fresh in my mind, even though it's very noisy, as you can hear. Sorry to hear about all your house dramas and that your latest contract has fallen through. It is bloody annoying. But it kind of sounds to me like you really need a champion on your side. And although you didn't really address this, it might be because you didn't address it or because you didn't have it, but surely your real estate agent should be organizing this sort of crap, i.e. because you've got some kind of, whatever it is, cornerstone house building, I don't even know what that means, surely when a buyer is making an offer, and the buyer says the things like, oh, we've got to get our, you know, building inspection. Now, I'm judging that most people are not professional house buyers, and they don't know, and they don't have a friend who's a building inspector. Now, don't they ask the real estate agent or realtor, I don't know what they say in New Zealand anyway, and say, oh, so who can we get to do a building inspection? And if your real estate agent, who is going to earn thousands of dollars in commission on your sale of your house, had half a brain, surely they would say, here's two places to try, and would mention the fact that the house is built with this different construction method, and say, you need to call one of these two building inspectors because they actually have professional experience in this style of house construction. Now, isn't that bloody obvious? I don't know. I would be, other than raising that with them, I would be simply going to a different real estate agent and listing my house somewhere else, because that seems kind of obvious with the dramas you've had now twice in a row.
Okay, I'm going to stop there for a second. The problem with that is, I mean, it does sound like it would be a logical thing to do, only they're not allowed to by law. When the Realtor Act, or whatever the heck it's called, was changed some years back, among the many provisions were ones requiring openness, transparency, and basically hands-off for a lot of that sort of thing. They're not legally allowed to recommend any home inspection company or person who can do a home inspection. In some cases, they can provide a long list of people and say, these are all the home inspection companies that we know of, or something like that. But they can't steer a client to any home inspection firm to do that. If it's not an actual criminal offense, and it could be, it's certainly a violation of their ethics, of their code of ethics that all the realtors have to subscribe to, or they'll be drummed out of the industry. And all of this, again, comes down to that fucking leaking home crisis. That because there are these houses that leaked, and because there were home inspectors that missed it, and because realtors tried to cover up the fact, everything has tightened down too far. It's gone too far in the other extreme, if you want my opinion. And now they can't recommend any home builder, any home inspectors or whatever. And they're actually supposed to have complete hands off. They're not supposed to say anything when the home inspector is there doing the inspection, because the selling agent has to accompany generally speaking, accompanies the home inspection company in, but they don't actually speak to them very much necessarily, unless they just need some clarification about something. But basically, they stay as hands off as possible. But it is not permitted for them to recommend any firm, or even a couple of firms, to a buying client. They can only provide a list of every known home inspection company. And the problem with the Cornerstone thing is that we know there is one construction firm in Auckland that builds these homes, who I've already spoken with, actually. He does home inspections, by the way. But I don't know of any others that are actually even familiar with Cornerstone, although there must be. At least builders who work for companies that are familiar with Cornerstone. But even if there were six of them, they still couldn't single those particular six out to give them. All that they could do would be have a list and list areas of expertise for inspections, which might be useful, actually, because say it's this is a plaster-clad house, but say it's a conventional plaster-clad house. They could say these firms have experience in inspecting plaster-clad houses or something. I don't even think they're allowed to do that much. Or if they are, they're afraid to because of the way the law is. But the bottom line is the reason why we ran into this problem, the reason why they can't recommend somebody who understands this home is because they can't. And it just went, it's all downhill from there. But let's go on with the rest of the message.
And as for having a champion on your side, I just want to say, you know, don't give up. It is very stressful. It is emotional. And you feel attachment because it's your house and you spent money on it and whatever. But at the end of the day, to other people, they're buying a house. And so they don't care about your emotional attachment. And it is stressful. But it's just what's got to be done. And even in 5 years' time, if you do this extra work on it and change this and rebuild the thing or whatever it is you have to do in New Zealand, because crazy people don't understand a different type of construction, it's going to be exactly the same again. There's always going to be things in building inspection reports. So I don't actually see that's going to change. It'll just be something else. And it'll always be something, because it's not a brand new, perfectly built house. So I just want to encourage you, say, you know, chin up, and maybe in a month or so, when you've had these extra few fixer-up things done by someone who knows what they're doing, that, you know, maybe you'll press on again and get your house sold and move on and, you know, benefit from it. Okay, well, this is Scotty. Thanks. Good to hear your podcast, Arthur. And all the best. Bye.
Thanks for that, Scotty. Yeah, I think that, well, I can say that all of the stress for me came from all of the work getting the house ready to sell. It wasn't the sale process itself, although the constant getting ready, then dealing with the repercussions of the first report, getting ready again to go on the market, then going on the market, and then the stress of waiting to well, as it turns out, to not have the sale go through again, that was all very stressful as well. But throughout the whole process, we were looking at the house as a commodity, essentially. Although we quite love the house, we're not emotionally invested in the house. I probably have been in other houses in my life, but not this one. Actually, not for quite a while, and certainly not this one either. And so, I mean, everything that we did, even clearing it out and so on, and rearranging cupboards and all that stuff, was all about treating it as a commodity to be marketed. And so we weren't particularly emotionally attached to it. That wasn't really what the issue was so much. It was just the constant getting ready to sell, then having to deal with things because it didn't sell, and then having it happen again. It was just, it got to be too much. And that's essentially why we backed, just gave up. And you're absolutely right that the house will be the same in 6 months or five, in 6 years, as it is now. It'll still be a cornerstone home, and still there will be people who won't understand what that means. The larger issue, though, isn't that. The larger issue are the parapets up above, you know, those end walls, I said, that go up, be above the roof line, and the fact that it's plaster clad. Now, I've met with that contractor I was talking about who builds these homes, about what our solutions can be. And what we're looking at doing possibly is removing the parapets and extending the roof out over them where they are now. Because one of the options is to put metal caps on them. So it goes up over the top and then back down to the roof. So it's all metal from on the roof side. But the problem is that complex roof joins and roof-to-wall joins are one of the hallmarks of a leaky home, one of the things they look for in a leaky home. And that won't change just because we've put a metal cap on it. So I'm still leaning toward the possibility of removing them and extending the roof. And the builder's off working on some ideas on how we might do that, what it might look like, and more importantly, how much it might cost. And so that's one of the things that we're looking at long term. And when he was here the other day, looking into that and all that, he actually went up into the attic and looked at the parapets. And there are three of them, you may recall. One of them is basically the front wall that you see when you come to the house. It's on the driveway. It's the garage wall. And he said that it had leaked in the past. There's staining on the timber, so it obviously had leaked. And part of it had elevated moisture readings, but it was within the normal range, what's considered the normal range for timber. The high end, granted, but still normal. And of course, we had the house treated, but we had it, the cracks and so on, filled in, must have been December of last year. And then the house, of course, was painted in January, February, whatever it was. And he said it's quite likely that that fixed whatever was wrong, you know, small cracks, and it filled it in. The second parapet, which is sort of in the middle of the house, he said had some moisture readings, but didn't seem to be leaking at the moment, because, again, it was within the normal range. It was just higher than dry, say. And, again, they could have had issues that were fixed with the painting. The third parapet is the one that was really the bone of contention, because this guy with the second building report said, he, in his opinion, it was leaking, and it was the source of the water that was in the lounge, and that had been in the lounge, let me restate that, and that he had talked to some of his, well, he didn't say this, but basically some of his friends in the industry, and they all agreed that it would be very difficult to repair the parapets if they were leaking. And that tells me that he never went into the attic for two reasons. The contractor that I had go up there found that that parapet was bone dry. It wasn't leaking, and in fact never had leaked by all appearances. So the home inspector was dead wrong about that parapet. Completely wrong. Couldn't have been more wrong. And the second thing is, I didn't know this until after the report fell over and I met with this contractor, because remember, he worked on this house. The parapets are actually made of timber. They're not made of cornerstone like the rest of the house is. And so, I mean, being timber, it's very easy to repair. And the fact that the inspector didn't know that tells me he never went into the attic to look. Now, the first inspector actually did, but the second inspector didn't. And so we actually have legally actionable complaint against the second inspector, but it's quite frankly not worth our time or effort to pursue it, in my opinion, or our opinion, I should say. So the parapets, while they are not a problem, could be in the future, and regardless of whether we sell or whatever, or an inspection, it's not even just about the inspections, it's about the future too. So we think that the best course of action long term is to remove the parapets and extend the roof over them. But then that still leaves the problem of the fact that it's a plaster-clad building. Now, there's no timber in the walls to speak of. There is timber, but it's not structural. The timber is used, there's two kinds. There's treated timber is used as the framing for windows and doors, and they also use treated timber at the base of each wall to secure the polystyrene before they pour the concrete in. And once the concrete's set, the timber is irrelevant. It's not structural. So even if it were to rot away completely, it wouldn't change anything because it's not structural. So there's no structural timber in any of the outside walls. And but the fact that it was plaster clad would still mean that inspectors would look at it and as if it is a leaky home. And all of the inspectors say, and they're absolutely right about this, that the integrity of a plaster clad home is dependent on the owner being vigilant and fixing cracks and keeping the paint current and all that sort of stuff. And that's absolutely true. There's nobody disputes that. But in 5 years' time, it's still going to be a plaster home and it's still going to be suspect. So we are considering the possibility of recladding in something more conventional, like weatherboards or whatever. But that is a very major undertaking because, among other things, the windows would have to be moved out. Our walls are very thick, and from the inside, it's a normal depth window, normal depth of windowsill or whatever. But from the outside, it continues almost that far again. So in order to be fitted properly for this sort of for a weatherboard home, the windows and doors actually as well would have to be moved out. And that becomes a major undertaking, and we'd have to get finance to do that, no doubt. So it's all up in the air. We don't know what we're going to do. But this leads into what I think is a very strange development in this whole home saga. I got a call 2 days ago, I guess it was. It must have been Wednesday, from the office that we had listed with. Now, the realtor, he's overseas on holidays, gone back to the country he's from to visit family and so on there. And while he was, before he left, he took down the sign and removed the key lock thingy, whatever, you know, so that they can get in the house when we're not here. And, but he forgot to have the websites taken down. And I forgot to follow up. I kept meaning to, just didn't get around to it. And I thought, well, it doesn't really hurt anything. And so I didn't really worry about it too much. It's certainly not the same as having the sign up. And so I got a call from their office on Wednesday from, actually it's the woman who's looking after his listings while he's away. And she was asking me if we were still interested in selling because they had somebody who was interested, and I wasn't really clear on what she was asking. Then Nigel and I talked about it that evening, and it sounded like she was just trying to talk us into relisting the property for sale because the listing agreement is actually due to expire. Even if, you know, if we'd done nothing, it was due to expire. And we're like, well, I don't know. Well, so I was going to ring her back the next day, and she rang me before I had a chance to. And it turns out that what she had was a buyer who'd been interested before, was still interested, but they didn't put in an offer before because they didn't want to get into a multi-bid situation. When more than one person puts in an offer at the same time, it's a multi-bid situation, and it's basically like an auction or more like a tender. You've got to put your best offer forward, and the owners can pick one or two people to negotiate with further. But generally speaking, the highest bidder wins, generally speaking, not always, but usually. And so they didn't want any part of that, which is fair enough because it's a bit like an auction. It's a bit stressful. And so, okay, fine. But they were still interested and they'd like to come and see it. And I said, yeah, well, okay, why not? Because I'm thinking to myself, look, they were interested before. Might as well let them have the chance to see it through. I talked extensively with her about these building reports and what we'd done and what we knew and all these sorts of things. So she knew all of the details, and she should anyway, because they had copies of both reports, should have copies of both reports in their file. And so she said, well, I can't do it today, but tomorrow, meaning Thursday, would be better. And I said, well, actually, that would be better for me as well. So I came home I had run some errands on Wednesday, and I came home and started tidying up and stuff, because mind you, we've been off the market for a month. So the house is back to normal, lived in this. And then yesterday morning, I got up and I cleaned the house, which I normally do on a Friday. And it actually was much, much better than on a Friday. So I'm thinking I might keep doing this. So I did all that, got the house, you know, all tidy and clean and shining and all that sort of stuff. And it looked really good. And I never heard anything. They never came by. I never heard anything. This is strange. And as I'm recording it, it's 2:42 p.m. I still haven't heard anything from this realtor who was so keen to show the house again. I have no idea what that was about. I have no idea what the point is of stirring up all these old wounds again and then just dropping it. Now, I'm guessing, because I don't know this, I'm guessing that the couple who were supposedly interested weren't that interested, or when they talked about the reports and so on, they decided not to pursue it, or something along those lines. And for some reason, the agent hasn't bothered to ring me to let me know that, which I think is highly unprofessional at the least. Now, I don't know that. There could be, maybe she was killed in a car accident for all I know. I mean, that's what it boils down to. I don't know what the situation is. So it kind of got our nose out of shape, to be honest, that they would pull this shit after a month. So I don't know. I thought, no, I'm just going to leave. I'm not going to respond. I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to do anything. But it was just really weird. Really, really, really weird. Anyway, as it happens, though, it was really good that I cleaned up yesterday, because Nigel's mom and sister are coming up this weekend. Our nephew is doing the Sky Tower Challenge again this year. He's a volunteer fireman. He and his brother are going to run up the Sky Tower in full gear. And to raise money for the Blood and Leukemia Foundation, it is. So it's actually our nephew's wife is the sister's daughter. That makes sense. So the nephew by marriage, in other words. And the mother-in-law of the nephew, if you will, and Nigel's mom are coming. They're going to stay with us. They're coming up tonight. And then the event's tomorrow, and then they're going back on Sunday. So it was good that I got the house all cleaned yesterday, because then it left me with a relatively low-stress day today. So that's good. Oh, one other thing, getting back to Scotty's call that I forgot to say about the inspections. Scotty, you're absolutely right. Inspectors will always find things wrong. That's what they exist to do. That's their sole purpose. It's not to do a fair evaluation of a property. It's to find fault with it. And most of the stuff that from the first report, most of the stuff that was pointed out, we dealt with within 2 days, 3 days, I think, of getting the report. It was all done. About $500, I think it was. It was all really minor stuff, and we got it sorted right away. The the more expensive stuff was dealing with these leaks that they supposedly found, or the moisture they supposedly found. And we're still dealing with that, and will be for quite some time, apparently, because nobody knows why. When we did all the things that we were told to do, spent thousands of dollars on these things, and it still is having moisture issues, that tells you that something in there, they basically don't know. But you're right, Scotty. They absolutely will find something wrong with every property that they inspect, because that's what they're paid to do. Now, I have one more voicemail message.
Hi, I'm calling from the land where the president has supported same-sex marriage and the state of North Carolina has not. Bye.
Well, that was Roger Green. Thank you very much for that, Roger. You've extended my phone line by another month, well into June now. Thank you for that. Actually, I know this is really, really meta, but this is something I don't understand. If anybody can explain this to me, I would dearly love it. The messages that Scotty sends me, I believe, are recorded on his phone, and they come to me as WAV files. I get them by email. And that's great. It works fine, except that I take those WAV files, and normally I run it through a program called Levelator, which evens out the peaks and spikes and so on that you get in sound, which can be especially bad on phone calls. And then I place that into GarageBand when I'm doing my podcast. But for some reason, I cannot place those files, either the one he sends me or even the levelated version of it, and I cannot figure out why. The only way I can get it to work is to open it in iTunes and export it as a WAV from iTunes, and then it lets me place it into GarageBand. If anybody has an explanation for this, I would love to hear it, because I certainly don't know what's going on, but it's just really strange. But anyway, thank you for that, Roger, and thank you for extending the phone line for another 30 days. And I think that is about it from here for today. One of the things that, as you know, that I'm involved in is Pride 48, which is the podcasting extravaganza. And this year it is again being held in Las Vegas, September 14th through 16th it is, at the Luxor in Las Vegas, Nevada. Now, there are special discount codes for anyone staying at the Luxor, and also codes for people staying at the Excalibur, which is part of the same group or whatever. And in the show notes, I'm going to put a link to the Pride 48 blog post that has those codes, because it's probably easier if you read the whole thing, the whole blog post, than just go to my site for the codes. But one thing they do ask is that when people have made the reservations, to send the confirmation number and your real name and who else is staying in your room, all of that's confidential, of course, to Big Fatty at ruined@bigfattyonline.com. Now, that is optional, but we're trying to get an idea of the numbers of people who are going to attend. So at the very least, we'd like you to tell Big Fatty how many people will be attending. And if you're not staying at the Luxor or Excalibur, that part would be good too. If you just say, and you know, hey, me and two others are going to be there, but we're not staying at the Luxor or Excalibur, whatever. Because it would be good to get a sense of numbers. But you might want to check out the blog for Pride 48, which is pride48.blogspot.co.com. Sorry. The Google redirect almost threw me there. pride48.blogspot.com. And we're going to be putting more updates on there as well. So that is it for today. I expect to be back sometime next week. I don't know when. I've got a Too Political to edit and post this afternoon as well. I think that will take longer than this one will to edit, but you just never know, do you? But yeah, that's it for today. And hopefully everything will get back to normal one of these days. Have a great weekend. Bye.
You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amrens Podcast at amrenspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrenspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.